This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of artist Naeem Mohammed discussing his project, My Mobile Weighs a Ton, as part of Arte East's Across Histories lecture series. It took place on October 27th, 2009.
And courage. And how we shift back and forth between these. A friend had recently said to me that if another friend or ally loses courage, it's actually a responsibility to try to bring them back to the space of courage, as opposed to being incredibly critical of their loss of courage in that moment. And I took this invitation to the talk to look at a particular period in my life, which was 2007 to 2008, which also coincided with a particular period in Bangladeshi history, where I definitely felt a loss of courage that also sort of went very much against my own ideas of how I conduct my work. I had a either self-built or reinforced by other people idea that I was doing work that was both art and activism, and the activism portion was, brave somehow, that it was fairly nonconformist and was taking fairly big risks. And then I found out that in moments of real risk, as opposed to performative risk, I really was scared, and I really was at certain points defeated. And I can very specifically look to moments from 2006 to 2008, where I lost my courage in a very specific way. And then I was interested in the ways I found it again. And of course, the way I found it was through other people and their examples. And interestingly enough, because my work goes back and forth between both activism, blogging, newspaper editorials, and work within the, for lack of a better word, museum and gallery space, it was interesting to see how work in one space was influencing the other and changing me in certain ways. And certain spaces, especially blogging actually, was sort of a refuge while I worked up nerve or worked up courage to start doing things that I lost sight of. What I'm specifically talking about is a particular moment in Bangladeshi history, which was from 2007 to 2008, which was our revival of living under a military government. And Bangladesh has a long history with military governments. We've had military governments breaking democracy from 75 to 81, and then again from 81 to 91, with a small 6-month democratic interlude in the middle. So we've had military governments for most of my adult life. And 91 to 2006 is the first period that we actually had full democracy since our independence. But we also have this politics that's very different from Pakistan in certain ways. And I bring up Pakistan because, of course, up to 71, we were part of Pakistan. So the histories were linked and then they separated, which is that Pakistan has in many ways had a really difficult time overthrowing military governments. And we've actually been really successful, or I would say we've been really lucky, in the sense that our military dictators were never as strong as Pakistan's military dictators. They were never as persistent as Pakistan's military dictators. So more of a democracy movement built up. But the last 2 years also showed me how lucky we were, because when luck ran out, you could suddenly see how easy it was to get into a period of no democracy. And I always think of Burma as the example of a country that should be democratic, has the most photogenic icon possible, and yet is still under military government. So 2007 to 2008 was also a period that I was in Bangladesh, I would say full time. Before that, I had spent many years living in New York and going to Bangladesh for a few months. And now I was there full time with no recourse to coming back necessarily, because I was there for the long haul, which completely changed the way I was operating within that context. And it was very interesting and scary to see how things were changing when you suddenly didn't have the access to that return flight, or you didn't know when that return flight was, you were actually there. What I want to do is, if you'll bear with me, a little bit of history of this period, and also to talk about how things changed for us, those of us who are working in various media. And I'll talk about this image a little bit later, but this headline to me is very interesting, Journalism Without Fear or Favor. It's a newspaper that I used to work for, and 2007, 2008, we saw very clearly how easy it was to break this idea of without fear. So I'll start with September 2006. And sure, yeah. Do people want the light on or off? What do people prefer? What will help people stay awake? Okay, good. So September 2006, to go through many months of history, Bangladesh is what people say is on the brink. In a way, let's say that Pakistan is now considered on the brink. When the country is collapsing, there have been months and months of strikes. The government in power is refusing to go to elections, and the opposition is refusing to accept the government. The streets are basically immobilized. And it's a scenario that's very common, with the difference, of course, that this is a Muslim-majority country. So now, of course, since 2001, there's a tremendous interest from Washington also in what's going on with this country, which on a daily basis also impacts what you're dealing with, because you're in Bangladesh working on projects, and yet you know that Washington is taking an incredible interest in instability. And we all know, if we just look at Pakistan and Afghanistan now, that instability is a really dangerous situation to be in vis-a-vis Western powers, because of what that can lead to. It's a period when the military sometimes comes into the streets, sometimes the police, but there's always this idea that the country is spiraling out of control, and the question of democracy and whether democracy can serve this country is coming up again and again. And this very seductive idea, which I will talk about later in the presentation, of the Singapore model, which is that you have a benevolent dictatorship until you are ready, which is twinned with this idea that certain countries are not ready for democracy yet, which is twinned with a statement that came out even out of some of the embassies, that this is a hot climate, people are very temperamental, they're not ready for this idea of democracy. And in September 2006 was also the coup in Thailand. A lot of these screenshots are actually from a blog that I'm very heavily involved in Bangladesh, called Drishtipat, which is very good about sort of teasing out these connections. Many of these things that happened in the Thailand case repeated for Bangladesh as well, the idea of a Democratic Reform Council, which in Burma was the SLORC, also revived in Bangladesh. And we saw how very clearly certain ideas could also very easily go back and forth between countries. So in this period, I was very much focused on writing newspaper editorials. I wasn't working on any art projects. I wasn't focused on anything outside of Bangladesh. It was very much about influencing the public opinion with this fear that many of us had that the military was coming. This is one of the first op-eds I wrote in that period against the military, called The Generals in Their Labyrinth, which is of course a Marquez take. And it also had a heavily biographical aspect, because my father is a retired army officer. He retired as a major general. I had an uncle who was the finance minister of the previous military junta from 81 to 91. And as we'll see later, I had another uncle who was in the government, in the military junta that took over from 2007, 2008. So in some ways, I was very close to what I was criticizing and very familiar with it. Maybe that also gave me a little bit of what I considered courage in some ways, because I could talk from inside an army family and be very critical of the army. And so that gives you a little bit of protection, because the army does understand that when somebody's from within those families, you're considered part of, you're considered alumni in certain ways. In a way that civilians cannot criticize the army. You know, in Pakistan, people say that the three elements are Allah, army, and America. In Bangladesh, there's two elements, Allah and army, and the army is also always considered beyond reproach. October 2006, temperatures start rising even more. We become extremely concerned that the army is coming, and we start doing these things about, this is previous to Twitter, what are you going to do if the internet shuts down? How will you send information out? We start setting up all these mechanisms, which end up all being necessary. December 2006, I wrote another editorial called Here Comes the Khaki Again. And again, somewhat autobiographical, very much predicting what's going to happen. I can see the newspaper editor becoming increasingly more nervous. So I have a line in there where I talk about the army dirtying their hands, and he edits it out and he tells me it's for your own good. And I also go along because I want the news editorial to be published, because I'm still operating under the assumption that there's still time to stop what seems somewhat inevitable. In this article, I quoted this writer, Humayun Azad, who wrote a piece called Rajniti Bidgon, or Our Politicians, in 1998, where he says, the number one hot-selling item is democracy. Nothing else comes close. Not religion, love, lust, hamburger, fish and chips, Coca-Cola, beer, or Princess Diana. I also talk in this piece for the first time in a newspaper page about my father, and I quote him saying to me, you don't know what you're talking about, in that way that only fathers can tell. It's a combination of love and, of course, reproach. The army is there to keep the peace. They are doing what the civilians cannot. Without them, there would be chaos. We are there because the politicians failed. We also become very concerned about the way that Islamists can benefit from the military. Because what we've seen from Pakistan is when military governments come to power, they always look to create power bases. And one of the very common power bases is the Islamists. And so I wrote this piece called When Pets Attack. And we looked at actually one of the things that Ayatollah Khomeini was quoted as after 79, where he said, after each revolution, several thousand of these corrupt elements are executed in public and burned, and the story is over. They are not allowed to publish newspapers. We will close all parties except the one, or a few which act in a proper manner. This quote I do at the same time that political groups like this are starting to do wall slogans, which are extremely seductive. Wall slogans that say, in 30 years, we are the only people whose hands are not dirty with money. We want Allah's rule and honest man's rule. We want Allah's law and honest man's rule. And it's true, the Islamist parties have never been in power. So it's actually quite seductive when they say, we're the only ones whose hands are not dirty. January 2007, the inevitable does happen. Aisha Siddiqa from Pakistan, who's the author of the book Military Incorporated, writes about the Pakistanization of Bangladeshi politics and Bangladesh's sleeping Frankenstein, the military. On January 5th, one of my fellow bloggers writes a piece where he says the Fourth Republic is now dead, 1991 to 2006. This is the end of democratic politics. So we all know what's coming, even though we feel we should be trying to stop it. On January 9th, I write a piece, and I have this weakness for Public Enemy, so it's called Welcome to the Terror Dome, as people know from the other project, My Mobile Weighs a Ton. And I write with this sort of nostalgia, because I've already written about the army. I've written two pieces, and I feel that I've said what I have to say about stopping the army. And it's almost as if all of us are saying to the Democratic parties, don't you understand what's happening? If you continue like this, the army will come, and neither of you will be empowered then. It's something that I've thought about often. When you write these appeals, do you really write it because you need to be on the public record, or do you feel they're listening? We don't know if anyone was listening. Certainly on that day, they were not listening. The next day, the New York Times runs a story with pictures from Jewel Samad and Pavel Rahman, from the protests, a third day of protests. Actually, the protests had been going on for months, but time starts from when the New York Times notices. It's also interesting to me that these are the only photographs I found from the period that were in black and white, almost as if when you change the surface and an exterior glance came in, it was necessary to leach out the color. January 11th, that's actually a blog post on our blog, but almost excited or maybe almost relieved that we know what's going on. State of emergency is declared, the military has come. It has happened. The Daily Star, which is a newspaper I write for, has a ticker that gives breaking news. And on January 11th, 2007, or as we call it from then on, 1/11, their JavaScript says, "No rose found, breaking news." By an unfortunate accident, the Daily Star collects articles and sometimes keeps them on archive and publishes them when they feel ready. And I had sent an article a few weeks ago, which was actually after Dr. Yunus of the Grameen Bank had won the Nobel Prize. That also happened in this period of chaos in late 2006. And I'd written a somewhat optimistic piece. I don't know if it's by coincidence or because they had nothing else to publish, but they published it the day after the military coup came in, which made some people think, of course, that somehow I had anticipated the coup coming. In this piece, I quoted again Humayun Azad, who had said, "You and I are of that clan, the one that sings in the middle of pain. That painful scream is the only song of this dead century," in a piece called "The Enemies and Friends of the Bengali Language." The magazine cover that I talk about is almost impossibly optimistic magazine cover that came out on December 16th, 2006, which is our Independence Day. A green-red cover, a cloud cluster of words tracing the shape of the map, and then shaping out the flag. Among the many words, I can make out the following: terrorism, crossfire, bomb blasts, traffic jam, murder, poison pen, militancy, brain drain, fundamentalism, gas crisis, bribery, water crisis, inflation, scandal, famine, fraud, bank loot, blackout. And underneath that long litany, an impossible defiance. Standing in the middle of a pile of smoke, we still dream of a prosperous, stable Bangladesh. A country where the fundamentalists will have no space, where we can smash their throne of blood to pieces. Bengalis are on a cursed journey, but we still dream among the ashes. So the military comes to power, and this is where a strange thing happens. Those of us who consider ourselves lifelong opponents of any sort of military rule find ourselves in this strange situation where we don't know what to do. We hate the military, but we hate the chaos more. And one part of me, and many of my friends, starts wondering, maybe we should tolerate the military, and maybe they'll come up with a solution. In other words, we start buying into this idea that maybe we are not ready for democracy. And it was a singularly strange moment for me, because I'm starting to believe, or at least think in my mind, although not write in the newspapers, ideas that I never believed before, that we're not ready for democracy. I wrote a piece at this time called "Come See the Game," because irony, as opposed to the sentimentality that was on display in the last piece that I just read from, seemed the only way to deal with the situation, that if I could deal with it in terms of satire. Friends of mine were a little more optimistic. They founded an organization at this time called Firiano Bangladesh, which translates to "Take Back Bangladesh." These are all people who were maybe graduates of American universities or maybe influenced by certain elements of the feminist movement. They started doing concerts with this idea somehow that the military was not the real power, that we, the citizens, were the real power. And on February 21st, Dr. Yunus, the Nobel laureate, announced his candidacy, and we thought that he was going to run for president. And we thought, okay, so it's not really the military that's in power. Our Nobel laureate is going to run for elections, and the military is just going to take a back seat, because the military is not more powerful than a Nobel Prize. March 2007, things take an ominous turn. This is a piece written by a friend of mine, Rumi, called The Darkness. This is actually a police marching into the steps of the National Public Library and escorting visitors out, because the army had just declared on that day, March 1st, that all institutions would close by 7 p.m. to save electricity, because there's an energy crisis. And it's a very classic military thing to do. The military is ensured with making sure the trains run on time, making sure there are no crises, making sure everyone behaves well, and painting everything white. And so this was part of that campaign where, you know, you wanted to study in the library. No, you couldn't because there was an energy crisis going on. And by March 14th, which is about a month and a half into the crisis, even those of us who were optimistic started realizing, no, this is a military coup. This isn't anything other than, you know, what we saw in the past, except it's a slow motion coup. It's a military coup in a velvet glove. It's a military coup that continues the illusion of we are just transitioning to democracy in order to also have the international community support all this. So we turn, naturally, like everyone turns, to cricket. Tigers of Bangladesh, which is the cricket team. And in this time, one of the big ad agencies launches a fairly sentimental ad for cricket. The ad was made by Grameenphone, which is minority owned by Grameen Bank, but majority owned by Telenor, which is a Norwegian multinational. And it's easy to enjoy the ad or laugh at it or kind of have a mixture. But what was strange for me in this period, I was completely moved by this ad. Even though I understood that Norwegian multinational taking our flag and slogan and putting it on people's faces is some incredibly clever form of marketing, and ad agencies are the ones that are making out. Even though I understood that this idea of Bangladesh is lost and we can find it again after 37 years in the wilderness is completely allied with ideas of the military, that they would rescue Bangladesh, I still, I don't want to say fell for it because that's too easy, I still went into it. For a moment I suspended, for quite a few moments I suspended all cynicism and believed in it and thought, well, maybe nothing else has worked. And that was an incredibly strange thing for many of us who are active in democracy movements, to actually publicly, of course, always believing that no, the military needs to leave, but privately wondering maybe they can bring this true. The thing that was fortunate for us is that the army also was not very clever, so that the way that they conducted themselves also very quickly broke this illusion. Otherwise, I don't know what I would have done after that as well. May of 2007, this is the beginning of the first disillusionment. Muhammad Yunus, Nobel laureate, who has breakfast with Bob Geldof and lunch with Angela Merkel, and is the most recognizable Bangladeshi in the world, abandoned his campaign after incredible pressure from the army and from the established political parties. It was the beginning of many of us sort of waking up from a dream. This dream that the military would bring you a better form of democracy. And then this was also the month when I personally first, was ashamed of how afraid I was. This is Tasneem Khalil. He's a journalist, very brave, and he had consistently been writing about the army and did not stop writing about the army even after the army came to power. In May of 2001, he was picked up on Thursday night, which is the night before Friday, which is a holiday, so it's very strategic so as to make sure that there's no media coverage, and was tortured for about 36 hours. While they tried to get all the information out of him. Where are you getting all this information about the army? Why are you writing about the army? Which embassies are you connected to? Which Bangladeshi citizens are you connected to? Where are you getting your money from? In that process, one of the things that they did get from him is, of course, the password to his email. And among the many emails that they found was an email between myself, him, and this other person called Asif Saleh, who is the head of the blog that we all write for. And among the many things that they found in the emails was one email exchange about a fundraiser that we had done for 25,000 taka, which is a trivial amount of money. But there was a very relatively innocent line in the email that said, well, Western Union charges a fee, so we should send it with Naeem because he's traveling back and forth between New York and Dhaka. So I'll just give him the money. And his interrogators very strategically released all his emails to the tabloid newspapers, which at that point were very much enthusiastic to follow the army. And they published it in this huge cover story called, it's on top, Shorkar Hotate Laptop Shorojantro, which means the laptop conspiracy to destroy this government. And why it was very significant is that carrying money from one country to another, I mean, goes without saying in the United States, but in Bangladesh also, is now a tremendously dangerous offense. If you're accused of it in any way and if it's considered money running, you can actually go to jail for a really, really long time. And what's also significant is the way we responded. We actually had a line where we said, none of us ever had any conversation with Tasneem Khalil or any other party about any other fund transfer. It was very legal. Instead of saying, how dare you leak email headlines? How dare you make these accusations? How dare you torture this person? We actually played along with the script of the army, and I include myself. I actually went to the magazine where the piece was first published And I sat down with him and I asked for a retraction in incredibly polite language. And of course, later when I walked away from it, I realized that I had lost even more by going to him, because I had shown him fear. I had shown him that, yes, you do have that power. You publish an article and I'm actually scared. And will you please retract it? And it was the beginning of this period where we all, I would say, became, you know, a lot more scared. Tasneem was tortured. Tasneem was released. He ended up getting political asylum to Sweden. He has not been back to Bangladesh since 2007. He was at one point a close friend of mine. He's not as close anymore, and I think he's not as close with many of us now because he was deeply disappointed. He probably fairly feels that many of us did not step forward in the way we needed to because we became too personally afraid. This is a human rights report that I used to write, that I write a chapter for, and I write about this ethnic minority in the southeast. And the key aspect of that ethnic minority is that they're in a zone that's under complete military occupation. So I wrote a piece. This was written, of course, almost 6 months before this period. And when this report was going to the press, I actually called up the editor and I said, can you use a pseudonym for me? Because things are so heated, I want to use a pseudonym. And they, of course, obliged because, you know, that's what you do in this period. But it was very sobering for me to be willingly using pseudonyms. Shuddhabrata Sen Gupta of Rux Media Collective and I had some email exchanges in this period. And he said, you should not only use pseudonyms, you should use multiple pseudonyms. So you're creating the idea of a community, and you should use pseudonyms that are really easy to actually break. So I use these five pseudonyms, actually, and the first two for blogging, the second two for writing newspaper op-eds, and the third one for things that we put in blogs that we ourselves didn't control, because we also didn't trust other blogs at that time. So, for example, the second one, Eshob Din Ratri, means these days and nights, but it's also the name of a really popular TV serial in the 1980s. So there were these little sort of signals that we would give of at least our age group or our interests. The fourth pseudonym that I use, Shombhu Rahmat, is actually from a famous novel called A River Called Titus, and it's Titash, and it's a combination. The first name, Shombhu, is actually a Hindu name, sort of, and Rahmat is a nominally Muslim surname, so it was also an attempt to create a semi-secular identity. But what was interesting also is while I'm using these pseudonyms, one of the newspaper editors that I'm very close to called me up one day and he said, you know, your pseudonyms are really easy to break. Shaher Zaidi is obviously Sheherazade, and Zaidi is not a Bengali last name. Shombhu Rahmat is obviously a fake name in the way it's structured. The other pseudonyms are also really easy to break. So people can figure it out. So are you just going with the illusion of safety while continuing, and is the form of rebellion or not? And I didn't really know the answer to the question. I do know that I continued to use the pseudonyms, either for newspaper articles or for blog posting, up to this point. And this was, it was really strange for me because I've never worked under a pseudonym ever in my life. And pseudonyms have always associated with not anonymity, but cowardice. And here I was doing it. And yet knowing very well that if somebody really wanted to track it down, they would very easily be able to get to the bottom of the pseudonym as well. August 2007 is when the students of Dhaka University did something that was so extraordinary that I would say it both inspired all of us and in some ways sort of shamed us into thinking that those who had so much more to lose were in some ways also so much more brave. And that's something that Rumi Ahmed, who is a very prominent blogger, has said, that it's always the working class of Bangladesh that is on the front of the rally and that gets the bullet. And it's the middle class that then gives the statement. So in August 2007, there was this tremendous outbreak of violence on the Dhaka University campus. And it started from what was identified as a very trivial matter. It was a soccer match on the campus. And at the time, the university gymnasium was occupied by the army. And some army officers were watching the match. And at some point, they got into an argument with some of the students. And one of them said what is sort of a very classically Bengali thing to say in this sort of shadow play of courage. He said, "Do you know who we are? We can make you disappear." And started beating these two or three students. And then the students retaliated. Before you knew it, thousands of students were on the streets. And the army suddenly faced, you know, chaos and a university on flame, which spread from that campus to all the campuses of the country. And it was really interesting because the army or any sort of state power always operates from this idea of strength, even if they don't really have real strength. And it's a scenario of the emperor's clothes. Who is going to be the first to call out this force and say, actually, they're not as powerful as we think we are? What was really astounding is that the Dhaka University students are traditionally a very vibrant political force, but in terms of organized political structure, they're not that strong. And so for a group of university students to be able to bring the army to its knee was an astounding event for us and made all of us think, well, all of the fear that we're operating within is fear based on this idea of power that actually they don't have. So for example, on the bottom left, that image is on the second day when the army was already so scared of the situation that they announced that they were going to vacate the gymnasium, and these students had done a candle thing saying bye. Also thought it was interesting that it was in English. And I thought it was extraordinary because what we found out later, of course, is that the army, as with all security apparatuses, was collecting all photographs taken in that period and trying to identify students. And all these students were sitting, allowing themselves to be fully photographed with this space of complete not fear. And because I work with image, media image, image warfare is very important. So this is a photograph that managed to slip into the newspapers the day after the riots broke out, which is a student aiming a flying kick at an army officer's back. Later, the BBC published it as the photo the Bangladesh army cannot stand. And a lot of people say that this is the one image that actually broke the army's back. This sort of idea that an army officer could be attacked by a student in, you know, this kung fu move. And I would say it was the beginning of when many of us started reviving our courage with this idea that if Dhaka University students can do this, why can we not? And the thing about Dhaka University to sort of point out is that Dhaka University is actually where I went to school. But when I went to school, there was 88, 89, and it's very different now. Only students from a very lower middle class background now go there, because what's happened in the last 10, 15 years is the rise of what we call international schools, which teach in English. It's a very new phenomenon. They were not around when I was going to school. There were only a handful of 5 to 10 schools that taught in English. Now almost all of them do. So you don't go to Dhaka University anymore unless you have no choice. So usually it's people from villages or from lower middle class backgrounds. No one from a middle class background, which is also, by the way, most bloggers blogging in English, goes to this university anymore. So it's the most vulnerable community that was actually the only community that stood up to the army. And so it really made me and a lot of my allies start to think of this idea of these things that we were not speaking up for. But it's also tied to who the army's enemies were. So this was one of the army's enemies, Tariq Rahman. He was one of the politicians who it's very hard to think of as sort of a hero. This is one of his statements that he gave in 2006. His mother at the time was the prime minister of the country.
Shantir jonno majhe majhe shokti proyog kora proyojon. Prithibir itihashe hoyeche, amader Islam dharmo hoyeche, prithibir bibhinno itihashe hoyeche. Shanti protishthar jonno shokti proyog kora proyojon. Desher shokol shantikami manushke ami bolbo, ashun amaderke rukhe darate hobe. Jar jar obosthan theke jar jar kichu ache rukhe darate hobe. Ebong proyojon hole keu khali hote namba na amra.
So when this man was arrested by the army, it was a very strange time because you oppose the army, but you also oppose this person they've arrested. So you have an intellectual reaction, which is, of course, torture is bad under any circumstances. And you have an emotional reaction, which is you start talking about things about the greater good, which is, of course, very familiar from the ticking time bomb hypothesis of the greater good. And we saw, all of us saw, that we weren't speaking up for this man who was in custody. And people actually started circulating this video and saying, well, if he's being beaten up in custody, maybe it's okay because this is what he did as well. So the way I started speaking up about that, which I did not want to speak up about, is to start working on some level of abstraction. So I produced these drawings from newspaper photographs. So this is from a photograph of Tariq Rahman, the crown prince in the previous photograph, the prime minister's son, being taken away. The act of drawing from newspaper photographs is almost something like a first year, not newspaper photographs, drawing from photographs is almost an act of first year art school act. It can be amateurish, it can be facsimile. And I was engaging in this act as a way of also starting to talk about that which was getting taken away from us and that which we were being silent about. And I wrote a piece alongside this. And in one place I said, rumors fly of special rooms which are bright white. When floodlights turn on, the detainee goes temporarily blind. I wonder where these techniques are picked up from. One Thursday, a journalist called me up and said, I hear rumors that Tariq was beaten. Nonsense, I replied. He looked fine in court. I blanked it all out and went to Wakilur Rahman's opening at Shilpangon Gallery the next day. Wakil, coming back from Berlin, pleased with such a big turnout at his show. Why not? We had nothing else to do. So, that piece that I just read from, it was very strange. That piece was published in a booklet called Proposals for the Next Documenta, curated by Raimundus Malaskas. And you cannot think of a context more removed from Bangladesh, both in terms of where this document is being published, where those images are being published, and who is going to read it. And I was really struck by the fact that the only space in which I was freely calling myself to account and starting to talk about what we're doing within this military government is actually in something that's going to be published in Europe. It was sort of a distanciation device that we were using that seemed like the only safe, I won't say safe space, the only space where we could criticize ourselves and have some sort of exorcism for our own silence. Of course, if somebody asked me, I would say, well, I could not write something like that and get published in the Bangladeshi newspapers at that time. But it's also true that I continued to publish in the Bangladeshi newspapers. And so it became a dual audience where I was writing in a certain way in Bangladesh and then I was writing in a certain way for art periodicals. So I did this project finally in Bangladesh because I really went into crisis about the work I was producing in the blogs and everywhere else and submitting something to something called Proposals for the Next Documenta, which seemed as removed from my reality in that moment as anything could be. So this project, My Mobile Weighs a Ton, is actually based on this blog reporting that I had been doing during the university riots, where what I had done was I was going around and taking photographs from mobile phones of the aftermath of the riots, where I was photographing restaurants that had been burned down, shops that had been attacked, and I was kind of interested in this idea of collateral damage, regardless of who's in power. And these had initially just been blogs, and they had been done, of course, under my pseudonym, Eshobdin Ratri. And they had been done, and then months later, I started looking at those photographs again, and I came up with this project to work on mobile phone photography within the gallery context. And then I started talking about damage to image. And this is from the project statement. Something is making me queasy. We are inside an Asian century, and a local situation that is producing endless beautiful imagery, but it's all a little too gorgeous and refined. I get worried facing so much aesthetic perfection. Still need spaces for mistakes, rudeness, bacteria, and things that just don't fit. Politics come from the context in which image war happens. Mobile phone photos, blurry, low DPI, poorly framed, no rule of thirds, no color depth, giving you quick access to make temporary provocations without planning, intention, or press card. As accidental as the boy snapping his lover on Dhanmundi Lake. Koi, amar kotha shune hasho na to. Why don't you smile like you used to at my words? We crave more spaces for DIY. Yes, anyone can do this and everyone should. No barriers, no high culture priest, no hierarchy, no gurus. Eventually, of course, every rebellion becomes its own clique. That's when we need to move on to the next space. Friction and creative chaos. Accidental images get in the way of blueprints. And then my friend Onu writes to me, I need to get this out of my system. I don't know if I explained why this term FNF, or friends and family, as the mobile phone companies say, was keeping me sleepless. So mobile gives you this free talk time to call your friends and family, right? And you use this mobile phone to take photographs and then you do a show, right? During curfew, communication was brought to a standstill because the potatoes, I mean the army, just switched off a button. All our lots and lots of FNFs, friends and families, all switched off at the same time. Silence. Every time I've been trying to talk potato politics, you've been paranoid and asking me not to talk about this on the phone. So yeah, our phones are tapped. Brains are being eaten raw before they've had time to foment the slightest ideas of rebellion. Our brightest and most courageous are being imprisoned and silenced. In other words, what does FNF bring me if I can't talk politics, organize demos, discuss religion with my friends? Silence. This was a portion where, speaking of the need for bread and circuses, I looked at the results for the SSC exam, which is the exam you give after 10th grade. The military realized that they needed spectacle and they needed distraction. So that year, under military government, the SSC exams had record results where there was almost an 87% pass rate getting what we call GPA 5.0. When I went to school in Bangladesh, there was no GPS system, first of all, but pass rates used to be around 40%. So it was an extraordinary result, which created this sort of visual drama of all these people giving the V sign. The V sign, by the way, used to be a very political sign in Bangladesh, unlike the, let's say, Japanese version, which over time, by the time you get to 2007, has become just an indicator of good results. And then we wanted to talk about this distraction mechanism. This was, of course, the idea of that infamous soccer match that inspired the university riots. That was the beginning of the breaking of the army. And I used a Google map of Dhaka with the red transformers, whom I've never liked, actually, personally, standing in for the army and guarding cantonment and a soccer match. And this project also made me think of something else, which is what happens when your breadcrumbs that you're littering to avoid the military censors, because I also didn't want the show to be shut down, are elliptical enough that a portion of the audience doesn't even understand what you're talking about. Then who are you talking to? Because I had that a lot with this project. Because we had the shopping room, and that's a scale model of a shopping mall down there. It's this size. And Aroggo is actually a spoof on Agora, which is one of the big shopping malls. And Aroggo means getting healed, not being sick anymore. And that portion of the project was actually a riff on this idea that when the curfew broke, the only thing that people were doing was going to the shops and quickly buying food, which is a far cry from the sort of rebellion that we are used to expecting. This is me smashing a pile of mobile phones for the project. And this is Mahmoud Darwish who died that month. So that project led to a sequel where I started going around Dhaka and mapping the invisible presence of the army. All the places where the military was starting to extend its hand in the guise of civilian oversight. So in the university, of course, there was a gymnasium that was now army controlled. This is the cantonment area. This is sort of where I didn't grow up here, but this is where my father would go every morning and I'd go with him. But the only issue is that the cantonment area didn't used to be here. It used to be almost a mile and a half back. And one of the things that we now see with modern sort of rapid industrialization is that there are all these highway projects to build highways and roads and buildings. And the army is considered the most reliable subcontractor to work on these projects. They're often the most reliable people, or they say we're the fastest. So the army got the subcontracting to build this new highway. But of course, when you build a highway, that also means that you extend the area where the army is working. So one morning I went by and I saw a sign, and that sign basically says, this is the beginning of the cantonment area. And it's a mile ahead of where it used to be, and it faces the Prime Minister's office. So you draw the conclusion of what it means for the future of democracy if the Prime Minister's office is facing the military encampment. The army doesn't even need to take power to have power. It's the illusion and the idea of power. This was one of the buildings of the main business empires that the army started destroying when they came to power. The building is half destroyed. It's by the Rangs family, which is one of the big importers of cars. And it was also the army challenging directly big business because the army wanted to start its own business. And this is Trust Filling Station, which is one of the most lucrative franchises in Bangladesh. It's CNG, which is compressed natural gas, which is the default mode of transportation now instead of oil. It's actually environmentally very friendly. And the entire CNG franchise in Bangladesh has gone to Trust, which is a military-owned business. So, I regained some level of the ability to speak out, but I regained it rather late. And that's something I think about a lot. It showed me my own limits. And it also showed me that a lot of the work that I do when I'm physically in New York, especially because it deals with the political realities of the United States since 9/11 or since 2001, deals with the illusion or the idea of danger. But in some fundamental way, there isn't really danger because whether it's myself or somebody like Hassan Elahi who creates the tracking transients project so that theoretically the intelligence agencies can follow him, or Trevor Paglan, there's a parameter within which we're working. Yes, it's a little more extra than something else, but it's a parameter which has sort of an understanding that on a deep level, things will not go beyond a certain point. It's almost like a gentleman's agreement that the visual arts has with the power structure. And what I found in Bangladesh in this period is that there's no such gentleman's agreement. There's no such, well, I'm just a journalist, or I'm just an artist, or I'm just asking questions, or look, what about this other piece that I wrote? So it was really sobering. And something maybe we can talk about after this. And I'll end with the piece that I wrote for Carlos Mota's project, La Buena Vida, or Democracy, which is a project that he did interviewing all these Latin Americans about their idea of democracy at the same time that Bangladesh was going through this nightmare. And I was incredibly grateful to Carlos for contacting me in late 2007 and saying, can you write a piece for this thing? And it'll be translated into Spanish, because I just felt that I could, it's almost like screaming into a void. I could say everything I wanted to say, and it would be sort of a dress rehearsal that would then give me the nerve to then do the same thing in Bangladesh. And it was a piece I wrote called Everybody Wants to Be Singapore. And I'll just read a brief excerpt and end here, because it was this very seductive idea that I would say many of us, including myself, also went for even for a moment. And now entered that concept, stability, that drains the blood from political life. The dream of Singapore. Hoggole Singapore hoibar chai. everyone wants to be Singapore. And now we see the Bhadraloks return, reborn into a new form we call Shushil Samaj, or civil society. The word Shu in front of a Bangla word gives it a nice sheen. Shumoti means sane thought. Shubachan, well-spoken. Shubuddhi, good idea. My classmate shouts at me on the phone, we call all of you Kutil Samaj or Twisted Samaj. Yes, he includes me. We benefit from the Shushil money going into galleries, art journals, and biennial trips. A war against corruption is announced. Target the political class. The raids begin and there is no end to the looted riches being uncovered. And I'm happy, just for a moment. One after another, all the big politicians arrested on corruption charges. A minister is sentenced to 5 years for possession of foreign alcohol. A chill descends on the Dhaka party scene. Everyone starts flushing their stash down toilets, or better yet, down their own throats. Beer, vodka, gin. For the younger set, Yaba is the party drug, a lethal amphetamine from Thailand, now locally manufactured. Man Dog and Pink Pleasure, honeyed brand names that drip off tongues. The big Yaba dealer in town is busted. Surprise, he turns out to be a relative of one of the politicians. Another round of politicians to jail. I don't think anyone sheds a tear for these godfathers. But we're jittery because we wonder what will come when there are no more politicians. Perhaps some are waiting for the international community to step in and restore democracy, that fabled Gandalf the Good. But no one wants to disturb plans to install a Muslim-led UN peacekeeping force in post-America Iraq. With Pakistan out of the running, Bangladesh is the next candidate for the mission. So many players in this double-decker chess game, only tunnel and tunnel, no visible light. But there are still protesters on the university campus. They haven't given in just yet. Their message is painted on the dormitory walls. If you're going to end politics, please don't tell me it's for my own good. Kill me before you kill my time. The caretaker government assures us that there will be elections in December 2008. The army does not want to stay in power. Voter list registration starts with computer equipment that will create biometric national cards. At the registration center, my mother's fingerprints don't register on the scanner. You're old, says the smooth-faced man. Your fingerprints have rubbed away. I'm in the next room. There are murmurs as people cut the line in front of us, breaking the orderliness. An old man dryly remarks, there are no aliens from another planet. Everyone comes from the same mother, even the army. Even if you beat it with a stick, the snake remains crooked. So who was the last man in front of the Tiananmen tanks? I wish I could be that brave, but I'm not. And it's good to know that now. But I keep thinking that planned history will not work. Bengalis still want a choice rather than a lobotomy that births a nation of shoppers. We're not quite ready for our Singapore moment. Thanks. So, I don't know what to do next. Maybe if anyone has any thoughts, things that you worked on that this reminded you of, or things that can supplement.
I have a question. What was your audience writing in English?
Well, the English audience is relatively small. The Bangla audience is always much larger. But the English audience is very specific. Unfortunately, it's a big portion of the power elite that does read the newspapers in English, and it's also a big portion of the heads of the NGOs. So the non-government organizations, which are the alternate power base. So there's the government, there's the politicians, there's the army, there's the NGO, there's the diplomatic community. All of these people read in English. What people say is if you want to build a mass movement, you have to write in Bengali. If you want to reach people who are going to make decisions and you don't have a lot of time to do it, then you have to write in English. It's a big problem, of course. It's not very democratic at all. I've always made that choice based on the situation. For example, something I didn't show here, but a piece I wrote that I could measure the result, was a piece I wrote in December 2008, right before the elections, when the army was saying that they were going to shut off all mobile networks. So again, mobile phones. And the argument was that mobile phones should be switched off because otherwise the politicians will use it to manipulate the situation. And we knew that mobile phones were absolutely essential if anyone was going to call in and say there's vote rigging going on at this center, the army is stuffing the ballots. Or rather, if the mobile phone is on, then the army doesn't dare do that. So I wrote a piece and I wrote it in English and I called it Don't Turn My Mobile Off. And I very strategically, and when I write a newspaper op-ed, it's very strategic and tactical and goal-oriented as opposed to when I do a project in a museum space, which is much more about a long-term conversation without necessarily a goal in sight and this idea of not being quantifiable. So I was very strategic. I talked about technology. I talked about how technology is empowerment, how technology is connected to business, because I knew that that was one thing that they would all like. And then I would say, we can't say that this tool is a tool for development and talk about digital Bangladesh, but switch it off when it comes to elections. And I know that op-ed worked because it was the only op-ed that came out about mobile phones. And the election commission was battling the army. And they use that article. I know. I mean, this is just the way it is. So yes, it's of course deeply unfair that what you write in English reaches the power elite or those who make the decisions, and what you write in Bengali reaches everybody else. But in a tactical situation with very limited weapons, I used English as my language to do that. It's something we discuss all the time internally as bloggers. That blog that I talk about that many of us are involved in, there's an English version and a Bengali version. And we write in both. And we know that the Bengali version is where the discussions happen, where it's really fiery, where people are calling each other names, where some 15-year-old punk kid can, you know, say, hey, grandpa, your time is over. It's very free for all. But when you write in English, that's being read by the people who are making the decisions. And of course, over long term, you'd want to build a mass movement, whether through art or whether through writing or whether through activism. But this was not a normal situation, right? I mean, it was a 2-year period where there wasn't time to build a mass movement, where you had to use every tactic you could.
So the protesters probably weren't reading any of what...
The protesters were probably not reading anything I wrote, no. Okay. Even though I write about them. Right. Thoughts? No more questions.
So you guys weren't able to bypass like the military cutting off the phones like they did in Iran?
No, they didn't manage to. For the elections, I mean, it's different from the Iran situation. Because in Iran, the crisis is after the elections. For us, we had the crisis in 2006, which led to the army stepping in 2007. And the university riots forced the army to give elections by December 2008. And stepped down voluntarily. I say voluntarily, it's not really voluntary. It's voluntary because you realize that you either step down now or you have the spectacle of hundreds of people kicking you like that. I mean, for the army, respect is everything. And the belief in their own strength is everything. And for the army, there's more things at stake than just running Bangladesh. I mean, although running Bangladesh is a very lucrative business. I mean, there's serious money involved, as you see with the CNG station. But one of the things that's very important for the army is United Nations peacekeeping troops. Bangladesh is the largest supplier now of troops to the United Nations. And it's actually very important for the army's internal stability, because when the army ran the country in the past, only the military officers profited, right? So you had the super rich class that was created, then retired and became business people. But when you go to UN peacekeeping missions, the lowest corporal gets a salary that's 100 times what they could make in Bangladesh, all the way up to the generals, right? So then that also stabilizes the army. Right, because then the junior officers look up to their senior officers because, you know, I need to stay within the system to get United Nations peacekeeping mission. I mean, people who are very critical of this have said, well, the army is becoming a mercenary army. It's an army for hire, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But many of us are actually secretly relieved because we feel that the United Nations involvement is actually one of the things that was a check on the army. You know, it's not an ideal scenario, but we would like anything to keep the army out of politics.
Sort of where that's going.
I mean, it's interesting you brought up Iran because, I mean, I have this habit sometimes of getting very emotional and writing things that I later regret because it turns out the facts show things are more complicated. And blog writing is classic. I mean, I've written all these blog pieces where later, oh my God, did I really say that? I mean, when Yunus ran for president, I was ecstatic until 3 months later it was clear that he only ran for elections because the army had said yes. And then when the army said no, he also backed off. So I really regretted that piece I wrote. But when the Iran upheaval happened, I wrote a piece called The Revolution Will Bypass Your Filters. Because for the first few days, it seemed that the Twitterers and every other form were bypassing the filters. Until 15 days into it, it was very clear that no, the filters are actually pretty powerful and things went from a tidal wave of data to almost nothing. We know that, right? And then it became everyone who was Twittering was somebody who's not in Iran, but who had changed their timestamp to Iran because they had been told to change it to Iran to confuse the censors. I always say we were lucky. If they had wanted to stop us, they could have. We haven't yet figured out a way to bypass that. If they had wanted to shut down the blog, if they had wanted to shut down mobile phone networks, if they had wanted to shut down my show, they could have. Probably no one shut down my show because a gallery show is not considered a real threat. They're more concerned about newspapers. And they're more concerned about Bangla newspapers than English newspapers. You know, that's probably why I can write things that are more... I can write more confrontational things against the army in English, where in Bangla, I think it would be a much bigger deal, right? I mean, the army thinks, okay, if it's written in English, no one at the junior ranks is going to read this anyway, so who cares? The diplomatic community is already against us, let's say. But what Onu, my friend Onu Jale, talked about is very important. When the curfews happened after the university riots, the curfews were lifted for 4 hours in order to allow people to come out onto the streets and take care of basic business like shopping, right? And they shut off the mobile networks exactly during that period. So from 3 p.m., let's say, to 6 p.m. or 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. And in fact, the show I did, My Mobile Weighs a Ton, tracked that. So the project starts when the mobile... So the project starts with like a... I made this thing out of sellotape, which is just the mobile phone tower signal that you get on your phone, but except with no bars. And then the project ends when the bars come back up. And the bars come back up when we're back inside. And somebody said, well, things have changed because in the old days, in previous days, you had no mobile phones. And you had entire systems for organizing on the streets. And after 10 years of mobile phones, with 40 million people with mobile phones, which is a tremendous number, it's one of the countries with fastest mobile phone penetration, people have become so used to the mobile phone that suddenly they don't know how to organize without the mobile phone. And so it's also very easy to shut it off. And then Tasneem Khalil, the journalist that I mentioned, was arrested and tortured. One of the charges that they gave against him was supposedly he was the initiator of an SMS campaign that said, kick army out of politics. Just that one line that had been forwarded.